We just heard about one way to start an exercise habit or add to what you're already doing. And now we're going to talk about the reasons why you should up your physical activity. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Our next guest is the author of a new book called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. Judy Foreman is the author of a nationally syndicated health column and an award-winning journalist. Have you experienced some positive effects from exercise? Do you have questions about how exercise might be able to help you with a health issue? Join the discussion, 800-642, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for joining us today. Your book is really, really interesting.
Thank you. And thank you for reading it.
Oh, yes. I didn't read the entirety, but I did read quite a bit of it. And there's a lot of information in there. My
goodness.
Yes,
you can look at the length of the back.
Yes. I was first looking at it, I'm like, this is a very big book. And then I looked at all of your notations in the back. I'm like, oh, well, I guess it's not as long as I thought it was.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. How long were you working on this book?
Oh, God, 4 or 5 years.
Oh,
a long
time. I can understand.
It takes a
that.
Long time to do that research.
Mm-hmm. And it's so important in a health book, isn't it, to have that research?
That's where the authoritativeness comes in, is you can really cite the studies and point mm-hmm. people to the studies if they want more information.
Because so many people kind of see one headline and think, oh, well, that has to be true. And
right.
nine times out of ten, it isn't. But
that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, most of us are aware that physical activity can keep us healthier. But how does it slow down the aging process?
Ah, well, that is the central thesis of the book.
Yeah.
In 2013, a team of European scientists came up with 9 major so-called hallmarks of aging. These are really basic genetic and molecular changes that occur over time with the aging process. And we can go into as many or as few of those as you want. But basically, exercise has a good effect on all 9 of these. And that's what makes it so powerful as a tool for slowing down the aging process. So let me know if you want to go into more depth, but I do go into that in the book, in the chapter on aging.
Yeah, let's just kind of cover those just basically what they are.
Well, one of them is called epigenetic changes, and epigenetics refers to changes in chemicals that attack or glom onto little pieces of the DNA to turn some genes on and other genes off. And how this happens is a process called DNA, the regular DNA molecule, methylation, which just means that there's a chemical cluster of little chemical components called a methyl group, and this methyl group lands in different spots on the DNA and ramps some genes up and some genes down. The pattern of DNA methylation is a very clear measure of how the body is aging. And if I could just go on for a second,
sure.
There was a really good, fascinating study not too long ago in Sweden where they asked volunteers, and I think they were mostly men, to ride an exercise bike in the gym several times a week for, I think, 3 or 4 months. And they did muscle biopsies on the men before and then at the end of the study. But here's the cool part. They were allowed to only use one leg. The other leg they just let hang there. And the DNA methylation pattern was way different at the end of this 3 months in the exercise leg compared to the non-exercise leg. And the net result of this is that physiologically, the leg that got exercised was younger, according to this epigenetic clock. So it was a really dramatic illustration of this whole principle.
Wow, what a great experiment.
Isn't it great?
Because
the person is sort of their own control group. You know, same diet, same sleep, mm-hmm. same demographic, everything. But the only variable was one leg got exercised and one didn't.
Yeah, well,
I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it does say a lot. It certainly does. What are some of the other of the 9?
Well, one is another major one is what happens to mitochondria. Your readers probably already know, but just in case they don't, I mean, your listeners, sorry, I'm a
That's okay. I've been known to do that myself.
So. your listeners, inside all of our cells is a little tiny organelle, like a tiny organ, called a mitochondrion, or the plural is mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little living thing that takes glucose and food, combines it with oxygen, and produces energy, literally energy, in the form of the energy molecule called ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. And you don't have to remember that.
Yeah.
But basically, what the mitochondria do, they're little factories that make energy. And they kind of poop out as we get older. With the passage of time, we have fewer and fewer mitochondria, and they get less and less efficient. What exercise does through another complex but really cool process, controlled by certain chemicals that the body itself makes in response to exercise, we mass produce more mitochondria. So it's fascinating that, you know, the whole biology of our body is set up to take advantage of exercise and, you know, make us stronger at the cellular level in various different organs. And with our mitochondria, we can produce more energy as a result of exercise. And that's huge. That's just very huge, and it has a big, good survival effect on human bodies.
Well, and throughout your book, you talk to a bunch of experts who say that humans were designed to move. Is that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's part of it, right?
That's a huge part of it. You know, our human ancestors did not sit around all day looking at computers or TV or writing novels or writing books or, you know, pushing papers. They really, you know, there was hunting and gathering. You had to survive. And in order to do that, you had to move. So we are genetically programmed, if you will, to move. We are not programmed to sit around. So, and we still have those genes. Those genes are built into our human genome. We are built to run, or if not run, at least walk,
right,
and garden, mm-hmm, and, you know, move around and not sit still for very long. So we are genetically programmed to do that. The anomaly is our lifestyle today in 2020, where we sit a lot of the time and overeat. That genetically, that's not supposed to be what we do.
Well, so true. And it was so interesting that for me, when I was reading it, about the fact that we were designed for that, but that we can do it for such a long time. As a,
yes,
a mammal, we can go for a long time.
Yes, we did. I think they call it a persistence hunting. We would just track, not we, you and I, but
right,
our
yeah,
ancestors,
yeah,
would track their prey until the prey dropped dead, you know, or was slow enough to be shot with a bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that required a lot of running. And there is a theory, actually, that running actually helped our brains get bigger, because humans have very big brains compared to our body size and compared to other animals. And if you want, I can go into that.
Yeah, sure.
Too.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have two chapters in the book on exercise and the brain, and those are my two favorite chapters, because exercise has such a powerful effect both on cognition, which is one chapter, sort of thinking and intellectual processing, reasoning, all that, and mood, which also is a brain-centered thing. And the idea, which, again, it just kind of blows my mind, is that exercise stimulates the production inside the brain of a chemical that some scientists kind of jokingly call Miracle-Gro, but it actually does cause new brain cells, new nerve cells, to develop in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is one of the major memory centers and also has a lot to do with mood. This Miracle-Gro chemical, its chemical name is BDNF, and it stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which just means it's made in the brain and it makes nerves grow. And the idea, it's stimulated by exercise. So one theory is that by running around hunting our prey, we triggered a lot of this Miracle-Gro, and because of that, our brains got bigger. I mean, as I said, that's one theory, but it makes a lot of biochemical sense.
definitely does. Again, so interesting. We're talking about a new book by Judy Foreman. It's called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. If you have any questions about how exercise can help you with something that's going on in your life, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. And in the book, you say that a sedentary lifestyle is a stronger predictor of premature death than obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and smoking. I mean, I thought that just blew my mind. How do you even define a sedentary lifestyle?
Well, that's a good question. Until I started doing research for this book, I sort of thought that inactivity was just kind of the low end of the physical activity and fitness curve. But it turns out that sitting too much, a very sedentary lifestyle, is like a separate risk factor. It's so bad that it kind of is its own category. And basically, I'm not sure there's a specific number of hours a day that tips you over into a sedentary lifestyle, but even I, and I'm a dedicated exerciser, have too much sitting. I mean, I'm sitting here talking to you right now. You're probably sitting.
I am sitting.
And sitting is bad for a number of very basic biochemical reasons, one of which is that, as we all kind of intuitively know, it makes you fat. It increases the amount of fat, especially what they call visceral fat, which is the fat in your belly that kind of surrounds all your major organs. And in the past, we used to think of fat tissue as kind of an inert lump of lard or whatever. But it turns out that fat tissue actually is a very active metabolic organ. It secretes hormone. It secretes these little chemicals called cytokines, these pro-inflammatory chemicals that create chronic inflammation all over the body. And chronic inflammation is the underlying cause for a number of diseases that tend to get us in older age, including a lot of heart disease, diabetes in particular. The inflammation directly leads to less good control of blood sugar. It can lead to neurodegenerative changes. Inflammation is a really big bad guy, and fat tissue definitely promotes inflammation.
So how much do we need to actually move to make a difference?
Well, the government recommendations, which are pretty good, are 150 minutes a week, which you could translate to 30 minutes a day for 5 days, and then you should do stuff the other 2 days, too. And that's moderate activity, and moderate activity has some technical definitions, but basically, if while you're doing it, say walking, if you can carry on a conversation, if you can talk while you're moving, that's moderate. If you get to the point where you're going so hard that you can't sing, that's intense. So it's sort of the walk-sing test. If you can sing, you're doing it intensely, and if you can talk, it's just moderate. But one of the points of the book is that more exercise is better than less. But the other point is anything is better than nothing. Getting up off the couch, getting up out of your desk and going to get a cup of coffee or going to the bathroom or get a glass of water. Every hour or so, if you can just get up and move around for a couple of minutes instead of just being plopped there, it really has a huge offsetting effect for all those hours of sitting. And that's pretty doable. In fact, some of the new Fitbits and Apple Watches and those devices have a little, you can program them to sort of give you a buzz when you've been sitting too long and it's time to stand up. And that's pretty helpful. I find that helpful myself.
Oh, so you have one that does that for you?
I do. It tells me to stand. And I know sometimes it tells me to stand when I'm already standing, but it's better than nothing. You know?
Yeah, but don't you feel a little smug that you are already standing?
Yes, so. I want to tell it, hey, I'm already up. You know?
So Judy, you know, there's so many wonderful effects. Why don't we do it?
You know, I didn't get into the psychological and behavioral aspect of it too much. But and I, you know, that could be a whole nother book.
Sure.
Why is behavior change so hard? It's been hard for a lot of things. You know, it's been hard for people stopping smoking. It's been hard for people, you know, not drinking too much. I mean, changing our behavior turns out to be a very hard thing, and it's not completely rational. I mean, we all know exercise is good. We all know smoking is bad. You know, it's not that our brains don't know this rationally, but emotionally, you know, it's hard getting over that lump, or that hump, even though people feel better when they do exercise. You know, it does take a little initiative and a little oomph to do it. One thing that definitely helps a lot of people is to exercise with other people. And then you sort of have a commitment. If you're going to meet your friend at 9 o'clock in the morning to go for a walk, you don't want to disappoint that person, so you end up going. Or you join a workout club at your gym, or you walk your kids to school with another parent or something. You know, you sort of have to set your day up so that you have a commitment to somebody other than yourself that you're going to show up and do a little of exercise.
And a commitment to yourself in that you want to feel better, right?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of reasons why you feel better with exercise. But there's a new twist on that, too, that I learned when I was researching this book. A lot of people have heard of endorphins.
You know what, Judy? We're going to save endorphins for after we come back from the news.
Okay. Sure.
We've been talking with Judy Foreman about her new book, Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. And we'll have a lot more to talk about after this look at the news. Do you exercise on a regular basis? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We will be right back. And we're talking about how exercise can benefit your health and help slow aging. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Judy Foreman. She's a health columnist, author, and award-winning journalist. Her new book is called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. Do you have questions about your exercise habits or exercise in general? What has exercise done for you? Well, we'd like to hear your thoughts. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Judy, before we broke for news, you were talking about endorphins. Why don't you continue with that line?
Well, yeah, we were talking about how good a lot of people feel after exercising, and part of that is probably just a sense of virtue. Well, I did it again today. Good for me. But there's also a biochemical thing. For a long time, people assumed that we felt good after exercise because of endorphins, and most people have heard of endorphins. Those are chemicals, opioid-type chemicals, actually, that are made in the brain and that do help you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that what really happens with exercise is the stimulation of a different chemical. It's basically do-it-yourself, made at home, made in the body, marijuana. It's called, they're called endocannabinoids. The endo means it's made in the body, and cannabinoids is cannabis-like substances.
Sure.
And it turns out that we trigger these in exercise, and that accounts for the so-called runner's high, which doesn't just happen to runners. Obviously, swimmers, bikers,
sure,
other people who exercise can also get a so-called runner's high. So it's like we're triggering our own marijuana, which is quite interesting.
And it's legal and it's free.
It's legal and it's free. Plus, you get that virtue thing,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. Well, we do have a phone call. Let's go to John in Brown Deer. Hi, John.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for accepting my call. I have a rather interesting story, which I can abbreviate.
Yes, please.
I've been exercising my entire life since I was in high school, and I was a college athlete and taught physical education. I'm presently 74 years old. And in the last 30 months, I underwent 2 fractures of my right femur, 3 major surgeries on my right hip and femur. My last one was a hemiarthroplasty of my right femur, of my right hip. And I've fallen in that period for 3 times and injured my knees and my back each fall. The falls were semi-serious. And I attribute my recuperative ability and my survivability actually to my maintaining a rather vigorous exercise program. And I still maintain it today, but not as vigorous as it once was when I was younger.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, John. Judy, have you heard stories like that before?
Yeah, I mean, aside from the very real trauma of what you've been through, I think your story is really inspiring and also illustrative of the benefits of exercise. I have a whole chapter in the book on bones, and the chapter surprised me in the research of it, and when I tell people about it or they read about it, they're surprised too. For a long time, we sort of got the message out there in the cyberspace or wherever that exercise was good for bones, and it is, but not necessarily for the reasons that we think. After a certain point, after adolescence, exercise can help maintain the bone we've got, but it doesn't really rebuild bone once you've lost it. And this is particularly important for women after menopause, obviously. But what exercise does do, which may have helped you, John, with your amazing recoveries, is that exercise through building better muscles and more strength and more muscle mass, and by helping people with balance, that reduces the risk of falls. And falls, as you know all too well, are the real problem, not osteoporosis per se. So people who can avoid falling, I mean, that's the real goal, not so much preventing osteoporosis, because it's the falls that really end up with people with broken hips and often end up in a nursing home because of the broken hip. It's a big deal. And I think John's story about the incredible recovery and resilience, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I would bet that that's a lot attributable to all the lifetime exercise that you'd been doing.
Absolutely. Now, you make a distinction between physical activity and physical fitness in your book. Tell us how the two are different.
Physical activity is a behavior. It's what you do when you run or walk or lift weights or whatever. Physical fitness is a sort of a medical, scientific measure of how fit you are. And usually, to be really accurate about it, they'll put you on a treadmill. I'll give you a stress test and wire you up with electrodes and get you to run or walk as long as you can. So that's a very scientific measure of how fit you are. And one of the things they measure with that is something called VO2 max. That's V as in Victor. This is a measure of how efficiently your heart and lungs can move oxygen to your muscles, where you need the energy and you need the bump of energy.
Yeah.
To make you move. That's a boop, yes. The oomph is what I was trying to say.
Yes.
Anyway, so physical activity, that's the behavior, but the result is the physical fitness. And physical fitness is a more accurate way of measuring how much you do. Because I could lie to you about my physical activity. I could say I run marathons every day. But if I were on a stress test on a treadmill, it would show that I don't run marathons every day.
So is there a way to test our physical fitness without actually doing a stress test?
There are more informal ways, and some doctors do this. You know, they get people to walk a mile in a certain amount of time or 100 yards in a certain amount of time, see how many stairs people can climb without, really getting out of breath. They're kind of more informal ways of doing that, too. And you can sort of gauge it a little bit yourself about how quickly you get out of breath or how long you can walk without really feeling winded or exhausted.
Okay. We've got another phone call. It's Reggie, and he is calling from Oshkosh. Hi, Reggie. What's your question?
Hi. So I'm a truck driver, and luckily I'm local, so I get in and out of my truck a few times a day at least. But what can truckers do who are pretty much isolated and, you know, lead a sedentary lifestyle and aren't able for our, you know, career to get out and move a lot?
Yeah, I'm sure your boss doesn't appreciate you getting out of the truck every hour and moving around.
Right. Boy, that's a tough one, you know, because other types of sedentary jobs like mine, sitting at a computer, I have control over when I can get up and, you know, get a cup of coffee or something. But I'm sure you have to make a certain number of miles per day or per hour or whatever. You could jiggle your left foot a lot. you could wave your arms around. You could pretend you're, you know, keeping up with the beat on the radio. But it sounds like you've already got the idea that you get out and rest as much as you can. Not rest, but move around as much as you can. But that's really tough. Well, and obviously when you're not driving, you can exercise. But there was a very interesting study that I don't think I've mentioned yet about the sedentary behavior, that even if a person exercises a lot, like 7 hours a week, which basically I do, and if you sit for 7 hours, like in front of the TV or, I guess, driving your truck, you're still raising the risk of all the bad things you get from sitting too much. So you can be like a total perfect exerciser and exercise an hour a day, but you still have to move for the other, you know, a number of hours that you're awake. And I can see that that's really, really a challenge for a truck driver.
Well, if anybody has any suggestions for Reggie, give us a call and we will pass
yes.
them on to him. Let's go on now to Jan, and she's calling from Viroqua. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a question. I also have a question about Reggie's situation. So my question is that several decades ago, I saw a fascinating book in a bookstore, and unfortunately, I didn't buy it at the time. Each chapter compared the capacity of a person of that age who exercised and a person of the same age who didn't. And it took it through decade by decade, so that by the time people were my age, you could see a very, very dramatic difference. And I've always wanted to get hold of that book, but I've never been able to track it down. And I thought you might have come across it in your research, and if you know the name of it, I'd love to know.
I don't know the name of it, but I have in my chapter, especially the one about running and sort of aerobic exercise, I have so many studies showing that exact phenomenon that you talk about. A lot of comparisons about people who same age, say 50 to 65 or something, the exercisers versus the non-exercisers, and the exercisers are way better off. They, you know, they have like 35% lower risk of heart disease, lower risk of death at any given point. It's amazing. And so it's all in line with the book that you found. In fact, just one sort of interesting little study, way back in the 40s, 1940s, there was a British epidemiologist named Jeremy Morris who studied London bus drivers and compare them to bus conductors on the same buses. So another great control group, you know, same sort of demographic, same rough salary, same rough diet, et cetera. The conductors were running up and down on those two-decker buses all day. The drivers just sat there driving, and the conductors had way superior cardiac health and greater longevity. So, I mean, Reggie, this is bad news for you, but they're running around, they're running up and down. It was much better than just sitting there driving.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, and Jan, you might want to think about just talking to your librarian too. They're always good at
right.
finding those books.
Thank you. My thought for Reggie was, would isometric exercises help him at all, where you're pulling against your own muscles while you're not necessarily moving in space?
Yeah,
I would think so.
Yeah, I would think so.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, moving whatever body parts you can without, you know, endangering your driving, I think would help. And, you know, one other thing that is a good thing. I have a whole several sections of the book on what's called high intensity exercise, and that's where you follow a protocol, and there's lots of protocols in my book and on the web. Just look up high intensity interval training, and this is something where you sort of alternate all out effort or close to all out effort for say 30 seconds or maybe a minute, and then alternate that with rest or very low key exercise, and you can get a lot of the benefits of much longer duration exercise with much shorter time commitment. So, Reggie, you know, if you have a pit stop, you could do 10 minutes of exercise and get the benefits of, say, 20 or 30 minutes. It's a way to really help people with time constraints and, in your case, you know, job constraints. So that would be something to really look into.
Great. Well, thank you, Jan, for the call. We did get an email from William. He says he usually exercises in a fasted state, like after having fasted for 15 to 19 hours, rather than in a fed state where, you know, he's eaten. He finds that he has more energy when he exercises in a fasted state. Is that typical, and is it healthy?
You know, the honest answer is I don't know. I didn't look into that very much. I've heard people claim about that, make claims about that, but I haven't looked into the science of that. So honestly, I can't really say whether it's a good idea. It seems to be working for him. That's something I can look into for my next book.
Keep taking those notes.
I don't really know. What I do know is after you've done particularly strength training, you know, like weightlifting, it's really important to replace proteins, you know, like 20 to 40 grams of protein after a workout, because your muscles have to rebuild. They need the proteins to rebuild. So certainly after a big workout, fasting would not be a good idea.
Okay. There's a lot of different kinds of exercises that we can do. Have you found in your research that one is maybe better than the others?
Yeah, basically the answer to the what's the best kind of exercise, it sounds facetious, but it's true. The best exercise is the one that you'll do and stick to. I mean, running is kind of the classic exercise, and it's certainly the most studied. The most number of studies involve people running or brisk walking. But there are studies on swimming, lots of studies on cycling. There's an increasing number of studies on weightlifting and strength training, which kind of used to be the stepchild of exercise and now is kind of front and center as very good also for other things, mainly keeping muscle mass. But really, whatever you can do, I talked to a guy yesterday who loved dancing. So, I mean, that counts. Gardening counts to some extent. Whatever you can do that gets you to move, some people go walk in malls. And provided you don't go into the stores too much, you can do that and not lose all your money. Whatever you can do. And it really varies. You know, my husband really loves Tai Chi, and that's not aerobic. And I keep telling him that, you know, he really needs to do something more aerobic, but he loves the Tai Chi, and that's certainly good for other things, especially balance and some strength. So whatever you can do that you find you can stick to and enjoy, that really helps a lot.
Okay, and we've got a call from Andrea, and Andrea's in Racine. Hi, Randy. Okay. Andrea, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am.
Okay, what's your comment?
I have a couple of comments. One is that I started exercising in my mid-30s.
And in what?
I started exercising in my mid-30s, doing aerobics and weightlifting. And in those years, they had the women lifting soup cans, which was kind of funny and embarrassing. But pretty quickly, they switched over to actual hand weights where we were lifting weights and being able to build our muscle mass. And I found through those years a couple of very positive results for me was that I could eat anything I wanted because I was exercising regularly. And I also found that it kept at bay a low-level depression that I had had my whole life. I didn't feel like I felt like I was able to overcome those kinds of negative, depressed feelings for years and years and years because of my regular exercise.
Okay. Well, thank you, Andrea. Judy, do you
have... Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Andrea, that's really... Thank you so much for bringing up that point. I have two chapters in the book on exercise and the brain. One is on cognition, and exercise is a very good way to help protect your memory and help prevent Alzheimer's. My other brain chapter has to do with mood. And you're absolutely correct. Exercise, especially the aerobic kind, seems to be a very good way to help prevent depression and even treat depression once you've already got it. I was really surprised and impressed by how solid the data is on that, just study after study after study. And in a number of the studies, exercising was as good as or better than medications. Obviously, if you know, a listener or many listeners are feeling depressed, it's something to talk to your doctor about, and I'm not being anti-medication, but exercise is kind of the first line of defense, and it really does work at a very basic biochemical level. It's the same chemical I was talking about before, this so-called miracle grow for the brain. Exercise triggers this chemical called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and that acts on cells in the brain, makes the cells grow, and that seems to be to work with another chemical called serotonin, which you probably have heard of, and together, those chemicals have a big effect on preventing and helping treat depression.
Thanks for bringing that up, Andrea. We appreciate that. Yeah. Let's go next to Rosella. She's in Ashland. Hi, Rosella.
Hi. I happen to be blind now. It's only been the last 10 years. But I began walking a treadmill in Monroe at the senior center 6 years ago and found out that in 1 hour, at 3 miles an hour, I ended up having done 6,000 steps. My brain just keeps count. In any case, once I got here, the treadmill available is made for shorter legs than mine, and so I was having trouble with the tread bunching and then snapping, and two of those, I'm done. So I found walking around a pool table gets the job done. It's better exercise for my upper body as well because I'm actually moving my mass 2,000 steps to a mile. Sometimes I do three. Occasionally I make it to four.
Wow, that's very resourceful.
Yes, definitely. Thanks for telling us about that, Rosella.
I'm just a point. I mean, I've never heard of a treadmill, the actual treadmill part snapping. I mean, it sounds like there might be something wrong with that treadmill.
Yeah, it sure does, because that's...
No, it's just not built for somebody with long legs.
Interesting, because they're adjustable, so... Hmm.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. The other thing you could try, you know, like, you know, stationary bikes can work, and elliptical machines can also be good if you're if you have access to those.
Mm-hmm. So good luck with that, Rosella. Next up, we've got Wanda, and she's calling from Eagle River. Hey, Wanda.
Hi. I have a suggestion for the gentleman in the semi wanting some exercise. I rode with my brother, and I commented to him that I just couldn't see the sedentary, you know, lifestyle.
Right.
And so what he suggested when we got to a mile marker, because most semis have a cruise control, it frees up both of the driver's legs. When we got to the mile marker, we would start to lift our knees and just stomp on the floor, just fast, you know, back and forth until the whole mile was completed, until we saw the next mile marker. You would not believe the burn that's in your thighs by the time you get done with that.
That's a great idea, Wanda. Thank you.
That is a great idea.
I love it. So as we kind of... get to the end here, Judy, what can you tell people? What was the biggest thing you took away from doing all this research for your book?
The number of different molecules and genes that are involved in the body's adaptation to exercise, and how, you know, there are people who want to take exercise pills or anti-aging pills, and for people who are seriously disabled, those might be a good idea, although the research isn't all there yet. But just how many dozens, hundreds of molecules get activated by exercise, and how it's such an exquisitely coordinated system.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Judy. I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but we are running out of time. We really appreciate you talking with us. It's fascinating. Judy Foreman, and her new book is called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. Tomorrow, it's Wildlife Update. Hope you can join us.